Good afternoon. So, in the Snow Day lecture recording, we talked about the actual implementation of the idea we introduced previously, that, well, our programs are going to have these addresses, they access that we call virtual addresses that aren't going to be the real addresses. Instead, we're going to have this mapping, the operating system's configures, where those virtual addresses correspond to physical, real addresses in a way chosen by the OS. We talked about the specific format that mapping is going to take. And our first step was that we would divide up our memory, both the memory the program sees, what we call the virtual memory, and the physical memory, the memory that the real machine has, into these fixed size units we called pages. And we specifically chose that fixed size to be a power of 2. And this meant that we could split all our addresses into these two pieces, what we called a page offset, which is where we were in one of these page size chunks, and a page number, which is the index of that page, starting with 0 from the beginning of the possible addresses. And we mentioned that when we were doing this, often our virtual addresses, the program addresses, would have a different size than the real addresses. And often they'd also have a different size than our pointer sizes. So what we called our virtual address was often not all of the pointer, but we usually had these situations on where, not, I guess often, where we had some unused bits, and then we had our page offset and virtual page number. And this was where our pointers were. So we had this virtual address that was the used parts composed of our page offset and the least significant bits, followed by the page number. And often we wanted to kind of measure how big the space we could access with our addresses were. And we had this notion of address space size. And we care about this for both virtual addresses. So the virtual address space size is the amount of bytes the program has names for, names in the terms of addresses, kind of the number of bytes we have labels for, and the physical address size, the amount of bytes the kind of real addresses have labels for. And one thing we noted is that, well, on our physical machines, we might have like a 36-bit virtual physical address, which would mean we can access 2 to the 36 bytes with unique numbers. That doesn't mean our machine that uses those 36-bit addresses has actual memory installed for all the 2 to the 36 possible addresses. So, you know, very commonly, you know, my machine could support more memory than I have in it at the moment. So very commonly, our physical address size will be bigger than the amount of physical addresses we can use usefully. We will still say our physical address space size and our physical address size is that sort of maximum supported by the hardware size, even if I don't have actual storage backing all that memory, all those physical addresses. So once we've talked about dividing our addresses into these page numbers and have physical and virtual addresses of particular sizes, we need to decide on what the mapping between them. And here's where we like took advantage of our idea of dividing up memory into pages. We're going to say that each page of the program's addresses maps to a page of the physical addresses. So we're using these fixed size chunks. And we just have this table, which for every virtual page, every page of memory the program can access, what physical page, if any, does it correspond to? And we called this mapping, this list for every virtual page number, corresponding physical page, if any, a page table. And this is the data structure that's set by the OS and will be used by the hardware to actually implement a program's memory accesses. So every time the program fetches an instruction, it moves from memory, anything like that, the hardware is going to look up in the page table to see how to actually access memory to do that operation. Now, so far it looks like our page tables just contain page numbers, but we actually learned that there's some extra information that's going to be convenient to have in there. And we talked about two types of extra information. So one thing that we wanted was valid bits, that we wanted to indicate that there's no corresponding physical page number, and since potentially all the physical page numbers are valid, we need some extra information for that, so we have an extra bit we call a valid bit that indicates, you know, there's nothing here. And we also added permission bits. We said it was useful, for example, to have two programs share their code but not be able to interfere with each other, to have memory that say, for example, read-only. And to implement this, we add these permission bits saying, is a program allowed to write using these virtual addresses, this virtual page number? Is a program allowed to execute code? Is it allowed to run things in user mode using this? So these permission bits on our page table entries, and every time the processor does a translation from the program address, the virtual address, to a physical address, it checks, is what the program's trying to do consistent with those permission bits? And if not, it triggers an exception, it runs the OS to ask the OS what to do about it. Same thing is true for a valid bit. Every time we do an access, we not only find the physical page number, we check the valid bit and see, does that physical page number even mean anything? And if not, we run the OS through an exception and ask the OS, what do you want to do about it? And the OS gets to decide. And kind of our simplest model for what the OS might do is, well, that segfault signal we talked about, that will send the segfault signal to the program, and probably that will result in the program terminating. But that's not what the OS has to do. And in fact, often it's not what the OS does. And we talked about one way in which that might not be what the OS does, with this idea of allocate on demand. And kind of the central idea behind what we're doing with allocate on demand, which we'll expand on more today, is that the page table is how the OS tells the hardware, you know, what to do, and the OS doesn't need to give the hardware a complete picture. So with allocate on demand, we said that the OS would tell the hardware about the memory that's allocated, and it would not allocate everything right away, and that's fine. And when the hardware complains, hey, this program tried to access something that's invalid, the OS would figure out, well, why did it do that? Did it do that because it was buggy? Or did it do that because I promised it that memory and didn't allocate it yet? And so we could do this trick where we promise a program a bunch of memory, don't actually set it up immediately, and just let the program run until the hardware says, wait a moment, there's no memory there. And then we figure out, oh, the program had a problem because I didn't give it the memory it wanted. Let me fix that, go back to the program, and let it continue. And we call this idea allocate on demand, where we deliberately don't set up a full page table, and we have some information on the side that tells us, you know, what should be in that memory, and we fix it up later, based on the program trying to use it. And so we can delay actually setting up the full page table until it's really needed. So questions on things we covered last time? As I mentioned, we'll do some exercises to review some of this stuff after this, but yes, back there. So the question is, how does the OS tell for an unallocated page what memory is supposed to go there? So the OS is going to need to have some separate data structure. We'll give kind of a high-level view of what that looks like for Linux in this lecture. But it's going to have some separate data structure that's for the OS to track what should be in the program's memory, and that generally is not the page table. Because the page table is just for the OS to communicate with the hardware doesn't need to know all that information. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
So in the recording, you covered that the page table gets pretty big sometimes, like in terms of memory.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember if you covered exactly where it's stored, but when I looked it up, it said that it gets stored in the RAM computer. So is that just loaded?
So the question is, where is the page table stored? I didn't mention it last time in the recording. That's correct. And you look it up and it's stored in memory. And we'll talk about that today. And does it all get loaded? The answer is no. And we'll talk about exactly what goes on in kind of our simple view today. And then we'll talk about how we make that fast. And that's going to be something we probably won't get until after the midterm, actually. Because how it's going to be made fast involves caches. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So as I promised, I'm gonna do some exercise before that. So just a logistical note. So as was noted in the announcement, Fork Lab is due tomorrow at noon. We anticipate that because they are doing maintenance on the substation that feeds Rice Hall and all the buildings nearby Rice Hall from Saturday morning, that the portal submission site and quiz site will be down Friday night to Saturday morning. And for that reason, we moved the timing homework deadline to Monday. But also, don't plan on using Portal at, 11 p.m. on Friday. Regardless, it probably won't work out for you. Okay, so let's do a little exercise. So let's say I have 40-bit physical addresses and 36-bit virtual addresses. So when I do my page table lookup, I end up taking my 36-bit addresses and turning them into 40-bit ones. And I use 2 to the 14 byte pages, so I divide memory into chunks of 2 to the 14 bytes. My first question here is, how many virtual pages do we have? And then, how big are our physical page numbers? Okay, who can tell me, how do I start question one? What would be a good first step? Yeah.
Maybe divide 2 to the 36 by 2 to the 14.
So you want to divide 2 to the 36 by 2 to the 14. So what's 2 to the 36?
Bytes of the page expressions.
Okay, bytes of something. So the byte, it's the bytes of memory a virtual address can name. I'm going to say name, so we can think of each virtual address, has a name, which is its address number. And our 2 to the 14 is the number of bytes per page. And if we do some dimensional analysis, we'll see that this is bytes over bytes divided by pages. So we end up with pages. That seems good. So we get 2 to the 36 minus 14, which is going to be 2 to the 22. So we have 2 to the 22 virtual pages. Another way we could have figured this out is that I could say my virtual address is 36 bits, and I know that that's divided up into a page offset and a page number. And because my pages are 2 to the 14 bytes, I need 14 bits to tell where I am in a page. My page offsets are going to range from 0 to 2 to the 14 minus 1. So the bottom 14 bits are my page offset, and I have 22 bits left over, so my page numbers are 22 bits. And if I have a 22-bit number, there are 2 to the 22 things that could represent. Questions on either way of solving this? How many virtual pages are there? Yes? How do I know the offset was 14 bits? So our pages are 2 to the 14 bytes, and the offset tells us what byte we're at in the page. So our possible offsets range from 0, 1, all the way up to 2 to the 14 minus 1, minus 1 because I'm doing zero indexing, and that is exactly 2 to the 14 possible numbers, which we need 14 bits to represent. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So for our second part, the size of physical page numbers, we can do the same computation I did for the virtual addresses up here. We can do that for the physical addresses. And we can say that our page number and page offset combine to form a 40-bit value. That is our physical address. And our page offset is determined by the page size, which is always the same between virtual and physical. So we know that's still 14 bits. And that gives us 26 bits left over. So that gives us 26 bits for our physical page numbers. Questions? I computed that. So another way I could have computed that is I could compute the number of physical pages with the same formula we did for virtual pages, except with the size of the physical address space, namely like 2 to the 40 possible bytes a physical address can name. And then said I got 2 to the 26 physical pages. How many bits do I need to represent the index of one of 2 to the 26 things? 26 bits, that log base 2 of 2 to the 26. Some questions? Okay, so let's do, say here I have a page table. And let's say I have 32 byte pages, which implies 5-bit page offsets because 32 is 2 to the 5th. And I have 8-bit virtual addresses, and I have virtual address 97. The question is, what is the corresponding physical address for that? Who'd like some more time? People? Okay, so as I've written down, my first step in solving this is, well, I want to take our address and divide it up into its pieces. And we know our virtual address is composed of a page offset and a page number, which is what this is, virtual page number. So we're going to look it up in that table. And my page offset is 5 bits, and everything left over is going to be my page number for a virtual address, a virtual page number, which I've abbreviated VPN on my page table here. So that means that these bottom 4 bits are page offset, and we don't use the page table to look at those. We use the other part, which is our virtual page number. So our virtual page number, and this virtual address is 100 in binary. And we see that that's valid. So that means that this access can actually proceed. It does actually have a physical address. If it wasn't valid, we have to say there's no corresponding physical address. And it corresponds to physical page number 00. And my physical address is the same idea as my virtual one. I have a page number and a page offset. I just, you know, have potentially a different size in this case, and it's a different type of address. So I take my physical page number, and that becomes my page number and my physical address. And I take my original page offset, and that becomes my new page offset. So putting these together gives me the address 00 10111 in binary. You know, or if I wanted to rewrite this as hex, I might write this as 0x17. You know, that's our corresponding physical address. Some questions? Did that translation? Okay, not seeing any. Yes, sorry.
So would you just replace the VPN with the address? That's your...
So my translation, I'm just replacing the virtual page number with the physical page number? Yep. That is what the translation does. Other questions? Okay. So let's, you know, go back to thinking about things related to how the OS uses page tables to communicate with the hardware, and how we don't have to have page tables like give the full story about a program's memory. And one case where this comes up is with fork. So let's say I have bash. Bash is the program that implements your default shell on Portal. And we mentioned that to spawn a new program, traditionally we could use fork. So that would seem to mean that we have our original copy of bash with its code, its global variables, its heap, its stack, and we need to make a full copy of that because fork was called. And it would be really nice not to do that, because making that big copy sounds expensive, and it is. And there's some places we can take shortcuts that we've actually kind of already learned about. So one is with the code. We mentioned that if we run multiple copies of a program, we can have the code be marked as read-only, so we don't need to worry about sharing that between lots of processes, and we can load only one copy of the code. So that idea simplifies our fork for the code of bash. We can just keep the same copy and just make sure it's not writable. We don't need to worry about, you know, not really having a copy, because there's no way the program can tell. But then we have, like, its global variables. It seems like we actually need to make a copy here, because these should be independent values in the parent and the child, and they could be changed after fork is called. We don't know. But we kind of know, most likely, most of these global variables won't be changed, and this copy is kind of a waste, right? We're copying something when most likely that copy isn't really needed, because most likely when bash forks, it's just going to do a little bit of work that won't change any of those global variables there, or maybe we'll change like one of them before it goes away through exec. But it seems like, so far, we need to actually copy all of the global variables. So we can actually avoid this using a trick that's going to be very much like our allocate on demand trick. So with our allocate on demand trick, we said, well, you know, rather than allocating all the memory the program needs right away, we're going to not do that. We're going to have it unallocated. And when it's unallocated and the program tries to use it, the hardware is just going to tell us, because it's going to look up in a page table and find out, oh, it's not valid. We can have the same kind of notification for the hardware when the program tries to modify one of these global variables if we mark it as read-only. So we want to detect, well, after we fork, does the program actually modify that thing? And only if so, do we actually want to make a copy. If the program never modifies it, just don't bother. And we can have the processor tell us when the program modifies any of that stuff by marking the corresponding entries of the page table as read-only, denying write permission on it. And that means that when the program tries to write to a global variable, the processor is going to say, oh, let's check the page table entry. I have the physical address. Oh, but wait a moment. Write is off. I'm going to tell the OS, hey, this program you were running, it did something weird. It tried to write, and you told me it shouldn't be allowed to write here. What do you want to do about that? And instead of crashing the program, the OS can say, oh, I remember that address there, I marked it as read-only because of a call to fork, not because it's really read-only. Let me make a copy now, so the child and parent have actually independent copies of the global variables, you know. And by doing this now, rather than at the time of fork, I avoid doing it for anything the program doesn't actually write to. So to make this a little more concrete, let's say we have our program running that's about to call fork, and here's an excerpt of the page table. So we have, virtual page numbers 601 through 605 in hex. And right now, these are all writable and have corresponding physical pages allocated. So when the program tries to read or write those addresses in those virtual pages, so addresses that start with 601 and then are followed by however long our page offset is, that's going to work. Then the program calls fork, and we need to create a child process. So rather than actually copying all the data in all those physical pages, what we'll do is we'll just have a new page table for the child that points to the same physical pages, but marks everything read-only. And we'll also mark it as read-only in the parent. And if these programs never actually write these pages, we're all set. We've done everything we need to do. But of course, you know, maybe they'll try to write something. In that case, we can figure out exactly where they do the write, and we'll get a fault, so an exception will happen, and we'll say, okay, at this point, I know that, you know, this process needs an independent copy of the data in virtual page 605. So at this point, we can make a copy, allocate a new physical page, point the program to it by updating its page table and mark that as writable because now it has an independent copy. And this idea is called copy on write. So rather than copying on the call to fork, we copy after the fork only if the program proves to us it actually needs a copy. And if the program never does that, we avoid making a copy, and that's why OSs are really eager to do this, because it should make the common case for fork a lot faster. And after we change the page table, like with allocate on demand, we go back to the instruction that was having a problem, and this time the processor will look up in the page table, find the writable bit is 1, and the instruction will run normally. So questions on this copy on write idea? Yeah?
So are we not trying to copy, like, in general, we're only copying if we're trying to actually read or write?
So are we not trying to copy in general, or are we copying if we're trying to read or write? We're only copying if we're trying to write. So if we only read, we still don't copy. Because, you know, it's not copying is equivalent to copying if we're only reading. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes, back there.
So right now, parent still has read-only, but the parent tried to write data with.
So the question is, what happens if the parent tries to access this memory with the page tables I'm showing you? It's still read-only. So in that case, that will trigger an exception. And I think the most common way of implementing this is during that exception handler, the OS will figure out, oh, I already made a copy, therefore you have the only copy, like we just mark it as writable. Potentially, we could do other things, you know, in the OS. For example, maybe, I didn't show it here, but maybe when we update the child table, we could also update the parent table, potentially. I think that's atypical because it's annoying to make work with multiple cores. So I think most commonly you just, you know, leave it as read-only and fix it up, you know, by doing the appropriate bookkeeping to know, well, have I already made, is this thing I'm pointing to already the only copy? Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Can you explain why the address changes in the child?
Can I explain why the address changes in the child? So if we were doing the full work for fork, after the call to fork, all the addresses would be different. Does that make sense? And they'd be different because the child's value should be independent of the parents. So here, we, in order to make this page work, we need to make its address different so it's different than the parent's version of that page. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so kind of a visual version of this is that, so what our fork really does is we have our program info and we have our page tables. And when we call fork, we actually get two page tables that point to the same stuff. And then later on, probably one of these processes will try to write to some of that stuff that's now shared and read-only. And at that point, we'll allocate a copy for that. And you know, in this example, the parent made the modification first. It could have been the child. And the other copy of it will not be shared anymore. Some questions? Fork diagram with copy on right. Okay, so one thing we kind of glossed over in our program layout is we had this memory that's typically in the upper addresses of our virtual addresses that I've marked as used by the OS. And pretty much all OSs reserve some of the virtual addresses for use by the OS. You might say, what's going on there? And what's going on is, well, let's think about all the things that we need to do in kernel mode that are when we handle exceptions. That code needs to live somewhere. And when an exception happens, we don't turn page tables off. They still are in operation. So we have to have that code at some virtual address, because page tables are still affecting everything the OS is doing in its handler for whatever exception happens. And that means the OS's handlers need to be loaded all the time in every single process. And so that's why typically OSs will reserve this space at the top to put all that stuff there. Now, we don't want that memory to be sort of manipulated by the user process, and that's why we have that user mode permission bank. We can mark this memory as not accessible in user mode, but still have it available so when the hardware triggers an exception handler, that exception handler has virtual addresses it can use, because we aren't going to turn off page tables just to run a handler for any type of exception. So that's what's going on with that memory up there, and that's probably the biggest reason why we have the ability in our permission bits to mark whether memory can or cannot be accessed in user mode, because you know, we all the time have stuff that's loaded as kernel mode only in every single process on pretty much any OS you're likely to use. Okay. So I promised earlier I'd talk a bit about sort of how the OS tracks what memory is available. And to talk about that, I'm going to talk about a particularly magical looking thing that for now will kind of seem like a diversion from what we're talking about. And this is something called mmap. So on Linux and Unix, and it turns out like Windows has a similar feature. You can map a file to your memory. And this is done with the mmap call. I'm not showing all the arguments here, but basically we open a file, in this case some file about that, and we get this pointer to an array that we can read and write to. And if we write to that array, it immediately modifies the file. As in, if I read the file immediately after writing to the array, I will see that change. If I write the file, it immediately modifies that array. So that array, for all intents and purposes, is a copy of that file. And how does the Linux implement this? Linux just ensures there's one copy of the file if it's loaded in memory, and everyone's using the same physical memory for that. Everyone, including like calls, the system calls read and write, you know, and they make that memory accessible in our process. So this is like a kind of useful feature, might seem kind of like a possibly convenient way to do file I/O. And The main reason I'm talking about that, this, is that this is actually kind of how Linux envisions a program's memory. So we mentioned that like we do things like allocating stack space that isn't really allocated, and you know, loading things on demand, and doing copy on write. So Linux needs to track what memory does a program have. And Linux's vision of what a program memory is that it's a series of these mapped regions. And we can actually get a dump of what that looks like for a particular process by looking at these special files in /proc. So in this example, I'm looking at proc self maps with cat. In general, if I look at the special file proc 1234 maps, this will show me the list of mappings for PID 1234. And this is basically a list of mmap calls that have been satisfied, so things that are mapped to the program's memory. And we might say, well, but wait a moment, a bunch of my memory doesn't have any corresponding file. Linux just treats that as kind of a special case, right? The normal case is there's the file, the abnormal case is there's no file. So in this case, we can see, for example, from this first line, that virtual addresses 400000 through 40B000 are mapped to the file bincat as readable and executable. And this P means that if it was modifiable, it would be copy on write, so it wouldn't modify the underlying file. And you can see we have just a list of these mappings, and some of them, you know, correspond to other files like the C library, and some of them don't correspond to any file like this one for the heap or for the stack. But this is the data structure that the Linux kernel is tracking for its own purposes to know what memory is the program supposed to have. And when we have an exception where the hardware says, hey, this program accessed memory that didn't make sense given the page table, the kernel is going to look up the address the program is trying to access in here and say, well, what should I do about that? So for example, if it finds out, oh, the address is in this range here, it's going to say, oh, that's your stack. I must just not have allocated that for you. Let me fix that now by fixing up the page table. If the kernel tries to look up the address and it's not in any of these, it probably triggers the segfault signal and probably crashes the program. But we have this separate notion of how the OS tracks its memory, and this is kind of the data structure that Linux is using internally, from the page table, which is the information the OS gives to the hardware about the currently sort of active regions of memory that the program can access without going through the OS. Questions? Yes, here first. Question, are these first two values the virtual memory? Yes. So notably, because we do allocate on demand and load on demand, it's quite common for a lot of these, the corresponding physical addresses not even to be allocated. Does that answer your question?
Yes, and then I wanted to ask what the last page
was. The question is, what is this number? So this whole thing, this 801 is identifying the device that the file is stored on, and this number here is a, I believe is the IDO number, so it's the number in the file system of bincat. So this is an internal identifier to more quickly find the actual file. Does that answer your question? And back there? So the question is, this last number is not the physical address? Yeah, so this is information about finding the file on disk. Because, as I mentioned, you know, large parts of this might not have any physical address. Because it's not loaded yet. Is that your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, and so I would call this idea that we've seen with copy on write and allocate on demand and this mmap, you know, what I call page table tricks. That we can just set things up to deliberately allow a program to trigger a page fault, namely the exception that happens when a page table entry is invalid, or a protection fault, the exception that happens when a page table entry's protection bits don't match the access we're doing, and just not assume it's an error. We just check what did we promise the program was in that region of memory, and use that to decide what to do. And very often, we just fix up the page table to tell the hardware what should be actually be there, rather than requiring that all to be set up in advance. And this is kind of how most OSs work, that the page table, is filled in kind of on demand as we need it, and we expect all the time to have the program do accesses, where the hardware says, well, given this page table, I don't know what to do about this, help me OS. And the OS is designed to make that happen and designed to run programs where this happens all the time. Questions? Like this. Okay. And so we've talked about a bunch of these tricks. So we mentioned allocating on demand or loading files on demand and copy on write. You can also do kind of more exotic things. So like we could use this to detect if a program's actually reading or writing to its memory. We can say, if we want to see if it writes to its memory, we can mark its memory as read only and see if we get an exception happening or not, just to see how often you're accessing that memory. If we wanted to say have a debugger stop when a variable is modified, we can mark the page containing that variable as read-only and wait for the processor to say, wait a moment, the program tried to access this read-only thing. We can do things that kind of seem impossible, like we can share memory between two machines as if it's shared memory, by kind of moving the values back and forth between the machines, underneath what the programs are doing without the programs having to be explicitly written to handle that. And I have one thing here I like to spend special time on, this idea that we can, rather than having our program loaded into memory all the time, we can say, tell the program, I have 10 gig of memory available, even though I only have one, and I only load a gig of the program at a time, and when the program wants to access some other stuff, I unload some of that memory, store it on disk, and load some new stuff. And this idea is called swapping, that we sort of have less memory than we show to the programs, and we implement this by using some slower storage like disk and moving data between disk and memory and back and forth as the program needs it. So this idea is called swapping, and I'd like to pay special attention to it, because this is actually what virtual memory was originally designed for. This is not how I introduce it in this class, because it's not something you want to do these days. So back in the 70s, 80s, the gap between the performance of memory and disk, it was a lot less than it is now. So this was a thing that you'd be much happier for your OS doing. Modern OSs still support this idea of swapping programs' data between disk and memory to make it look like memory has more capacity than it really does. But it's not very efficient with kind of modern disk speeds versus modern memory speeds. But it actually is what virtual memory is designed for. So these things I call page table tricks, where it seems like we're doing this hack where we tell the processor the program's not allowed to do this, and we deliberately have the program do it. Well, that's the design. That's what the system was built to do. And because of that, there's the hardware actually has some features that are designed to really enable that operation. So one thing is that we're very careful with, especially the exceptions that trigger from page table lookups not working out, to give the OS all the information it needs to implement these kind of page table tricks. There's kind of two things we need there. So one is that we don't just tell the OS, hey, the program accessed memory it wasn't supposed to. We give the OS the specific address the program was trying to access. The other thing is that we need to make sure that the OS can actually go back to the place where the exception happened, and it doesn't need to worry about instructions being partially complete. So as an example of that, if you think of the instruction like push RIX, this is implemented by modifying the stack pointer and writing to memory. We really can't have it be the case that if this causes an exception because the memory is not writable, that the instruction has still modified the stack pointer, because then if we go back and rerun it, now the stack pointer has the wrong value. So to support this, the hardware will make sure that we've stopped between instructions, you know, doing whatever work is needed to undo any partially done instructions. And this idea is known as precise exceptions. And the reason it has a name is that there were actually systems that didn't implement precise exceptions. And pretty much the universal opinion was is that made it way too hard to implement OSs. So pretty much all systems we use today have these precise exceptions where the hardware always stops as if it's just before a particular instruction. You know, even if that instruction is really complicated and had multiple steps, the hardware will somehow stop the instruction, you know, and undo some of those things so it's as if we stopped just before it. So questions about this precise exceptions idea? Okay. So next we're going to, as our last topic, we're going to talk about how we actually store page tables. And to talk about that, the preview is we're going to store them in physical memory. So to talk about that, first we want to get comfortable with some examples looking at physical memory and how that corresponds to our pages. So here, let's say I have 8-byte pages. That's 2 to the 3 bytes. That would mean physical page 0 is bytes 0 through 8. Physical page 1 is bytes 8 through F. Physical page 2 is bytes 10 through 17, and so on. And let's say I access address 18. So that's going to be 11000 in binary. We have 8-byte pages, which implies 3-bit page offsets. So our page offset is all zeros, and our virtual page number is 11. We look up here, we check that it's valid, and we find that it goes to physical page 000. So we take that 000, combine that with our page offset to produce physical address 00, which is this byte here. So our physical address and the value of that byte happen to be the same in this example, but that won't always be the case, probably. Usually won't be the case. So as an example, if we look at OX3 here, this is going to be 00011. This is our page offset. This is our page number. Virtual page 0 is physical page 010. And we copy the page offset. So our physical address is 010, the physical page number, followed by 011, the page offset, you know, which we can also write as OX13. And the byte we'll access is this 4A. The main reason I'm having this is to emphasize we have our physical address, not the same thing as the actual data the program is manipulating when it uses this virtual address. Yes?
Could you give an example where it's like a 10-byte page or like a 6-byte page or something?
Can I do an example where it's a 10-byte page or a 6-byte page? No, because page sizes are always a power of 2.
Okay.
Does that answer your question? Yeah. Can I do the 18 example again? Sure. So in the case of 0x18, this is 11000 in binary. Our VPN is 11. We looked that up, and it's valid, and it has physical page 000, and we copy the page offset, we get address 0, which is that byte there. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So I'm hoping this is mostly, except for, just being careful to realize our physical address and the data at that address are different things, that this is a review of what we did at the beginning of lecture. And the reason I'm emphasizing this is that we're going to talk about a page table not being this table on the side, but it's going to be in the physical memory. Because that's going to be our solution for how do we store these big page tables? We're going to put them in the physical memory. So it seems like people might have questions, but I'm not seeing hands raised. So, yeah. How do we get how long the page offset is? We got that from the page size. So we have 8-byte pages. So that means that our page offsets are going to be 0 through 7, right? And if we think of how this works in binary, this is 0 through 111. We need 3 bits to store that. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So, as I promised, we're going to store our page table in memory. And it's a table, so we're going to store it, sort of to start out, as an array. But now I need to represent these page table entries, the kind of rows of our table, as something, and what we're going to do is we're going to have our processor decide on a way of packing the information in a page table entry into an integer. So in this example, we'll say that we've chosen that we're going to store our page table entries as a 16-bit integer, where the most significant bit is our valid bit, then we have a page number, and then we have some unused bits, or maybe this would probably be where our permission bits would be. And this is an arbitrary ordering and choice. It's up to the processor to decide what do they want this to look like. So we've decided that each page table entry is stored as the 16-bit number. So our page table will be an array of 16-bit numbers. And to access an array, what do we need? We need the base address of the array and the index into the array. So the index, well, we're gonna get from our page number, from our virtual page number that tells us what row of the table we're at. That's our array index. But the processor needs to know the base address of the array. So we're gonna have a special register that the OS is gonna set to tell the processor, here's where the page table I have set up for you is. And we'll call this the page table base register, which will sometimes abbreviate PTBR. And this will specify a physical address, because we don't want to need a page table to access the page table. That's not going to work out well. That points to the beginning of our array of page table entries. And I've drawn memory as an array of 16-bit values because we're going to treat this as an array of 16-bit numbers. And we're going to decode each of those 16-bit numbers using the format the processor specified for us. So in this example, I know that for virtual page number 0, its valid bit in the page table is 0. And its page number in the page table is 0. And its other bits are all 0. And I can say, well, for virtual page one, that's its valid bit is one. Its page number is this value here, the bits after that in the second value in our array, and the other bits are all zeros. So we can see that we can read out the page table contents from this piece of memory, and the reason those contents will be meaningful is that the OS will have set them up deliberately for the processor to use. So questions so far? So we're storing the page table as an array in memory and giving the processor a pointer to the beginning of that array. Yeah?
Why can't the page table be stored at the very beginning of memory, like physical memory, like address zero?
So question, why don't we just store the page table at a fixed address in physical memory, like address zero, rather than having a base register? The biggest reason why is because we have multiple processes. And this scheme allows us to switch between a process by changing that register. If we had stored the page table at a fixed location, we need to copy the page table to that location each time we switch processes, and that would be a lot slower. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So let's talk about, if this is how the processor is informed of our page table, what is the processor doing when we actually access memory? So we're going to take a virtual address, which is going to have a virtual page number and a page offset. And we want to look up the page table entry for that virtual page number. So we're going to do an array lookup. How does an array lookup work? Well, if you think of getting the address of a particular element of an array, we multiply by the size of each array element and add the base of the array. Because if we think about it, if the virtual page number is one, we want to advance by the size of one page table entry. So in our last slide example, that would have been 2 bytes. You know, if it's a different size, we want to advance by that size for each, you know, index in our virtual page number. If it's two, we want to advance by twice that. If it's five, we want to advance by 5 times that, and so on. So that's what this times page table entry size we're computing. How many bytes from the beginning of the array is the entry we want? How many entries am I skipping over? And how big is each thing I'm skipping over? That's what that multiplication's from. And then we add it to the base of our array. And that gives us the address of the page table entry. But in order to actually complete the memory access, we need the value. We need to actually figure out, is it valid? Is the valid bit there one? What's the physical page number? So our processor is going to use that address we computed to do the array lookup and actually access the array by accessing memory. Then we're going to take our number we get out and we're going to use our format that we decided on to split it up into pieces. You know, we have our valid bit, any permission bits, and our page number. We're going to check if it's valid, check if the permissions match what the program is trying to do. And if not, we're going to run the OS instead of continuing on with the program. Otherwise, we're going to extract the physical page number, and that's going to be the upper part of our actual physical address. We need a full physical address, which is also going to have a page offset. Where can we get a page offset? Well, the original address. So we copy the page offset from the virtual address. The page offset in our physical address is going to be exactly the same. And this is the actual address we want to access on behalf of the program, the actual physical address. So we'll access memory with that. So in this scheme, each memory access the program makes turns into two real memory accesses. One to read the page table entry to figure out how to translate that to a physical address, and the second to actually access the data or code or whatever the programs are trying to access. So questions about our memory lookup scheme? So let's apply this idea. So let's say I have something like the exercise we saw before. I have the same page size. So I have 8-byte pages, which means 3-bit page offsets. But instead of having my page table just on the side, my page table is stored in the physical memory. And to know where it's stored, well, I have a page table base register, which points to here. So that's the beginning of my array of page table entries. And in this example, because I have not much room on the slide, rather than my page table entries being represented as 16-bit numbers, they'll be represented as 8-bit numbers. And the format I have chosen is that the 8-bit numbers at their most significant bits have a 3-bit physical page number, a 1-bit valid bit, and then 4 unused bits. That's just the format that our hardware has chosen. It's an arbitrary choice. We didn't have to choose that, but the hardware chose something that it's going to use. And our goal is to translate virtual address 3-1 and figure out what memory is that actually going to access. So our first step here is going to be, I want to translate this 3-1 into, I'm going to write it as binary because I want to figure out what part is the virtual page number and what part's the page offset. And this part here is the page offset. This part here is the virtual page number, 110, also known as 6. And we're going to look up in the array of page table entries index 6. So how do we compute the address of index 6? Well, you know, sort of our page table index 0, we know is 0x20, and index 1 is 0x20 plus the size of an entry. And index 6, therefore, is 0x20 plus 6 times the size of an entry, which in this case, entries are only 1 byte. So that's going to be address 0x26. That's where the page table entry for index 6 for virtual page number 6 is. And if we look at our physical memory, that value is here. That is the page table entry, but it's encoded as an integer. So questions about how I got so far? So I found the value of my first page table entry. I'm not done yet, but I've gotten to, I've gotten the value here. Yes?
So just back to the previous slide. The size of the PTE is 1 byte. And you're adding 6 times that 1 byte into 0x20.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that one hex digit was like 4 bits, not
this question, the size of, so I'm adding 6 times 1 byte to get there. Why am I not doing that instead of something else? So one hex digit is 4 bits, and a byte is 8 bits. So each of these two hex digit numbers is 1 byte. Does that clear up question? And it's worth pointing this out because I have seen lots of people make this error like on quizzes and exams. So it's worth pointing out, yes. Two hex digits to a byte. Byte is 8 bits, not any other number in this class. And just be careful with that. Yes, back there.
Where do you get the 8 bits from? Because isn't, don't you need like enough bits to display for a
full? The question, why, where do I get that are 8 bits from? You mean 8 bits for the page table entry?
Yes.
I was told here.
Okay.
So if we made a different decision about that, we might have a different size. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
And indeed, on a real system, it will probably be like 32 or 64 bits, because we won't have a 3-bit page number. OK. Other questions? OK, so we've gone to here. We've taken our virtual page number. We've computed where in the page table it is, and we've retrieved that page table entry, but we have to split it up into its pieces, check if it's valid, and also use the page number from it. So let's do the process of splitting it up into its pieces. So we have OXF6, if I write this as binary, is 111, 1010. And from this format, we know the most significant bit, 3 bits, are the physical page number, followed by a valid bit. So to check the valid bit, I see if that valid bit I just identified is 1. It is. We can continue. We don't need to trigger an exception. And then I take physical page number 111, and that's going to form part of my address along with a page offset that I'm going to copy from the original virtual address. And so this gives me, if I write this as hexadecimal, 0x39 is my physical address. Now, if I actually want to do the program's memory access, I'm not done yet. This is just where the program's accessing. I need to look at the value that's there, and the program's going to end up manipulating this 0C value depending on what operations it's doing. If it's like executing code, we're going to interpret that as machine code. If the program's writing somewhere, we're going to modify that. But that's the result of our translation. That's where the program's memory access will actually go. Yes? Would F6 not be 111011? Yes, it would be. Sorry. I didn't pay much attention because I knew those bits were unused. Other questions? Yeah.
Go over to the virtual address 31 transition.
Can I go over the 31?
The 1 is 4 bits, so that's why it's a 1 that you're starting.
How did I translate 31 to this? Binary, so yeah. So I just know that each hexadecimal radit is 4 bits. So 1 turns into 0001, and 3 turns into 0011. And I combine those together, and I didn't write the leading zeros.
Okay.
Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we don't have enough time to do this exercise, so I encourage you to do it on your own. We just have another example. Something you'll notice that we'll talk about next time is that if I think about how big our virtual page numbers are, say on a modern 64-bit system, they're like 36 bits. Our page table entries are like 8 bytes. So if you do the math, that requires 2 to the 39 bytes to store an array of page table entries of the right size. That's half a terabyte. Obviously, that's not what we do. So next time we'll talk about how we can adapt this scheme for large memories to make it more compact. And the key insight is going to be that we have lots of invalid page table entries we can avoid storing. So that will be our main topic, in addition to some review of these lookups that we'll talk about next week.